Hello, folks. This is Will Aitchison with Labor Relations Information System. This is not our usual First Thursday podcast. Every once in a while, there'll be a case that will come down that we think is significant enough that it warrants its own discussion. And that was the case yesterday with, to the best of my knowledge, the first body camera bargaining case in the country. That came to us courtesy of the arbitration process in Oklahoma City. I'm privileged to have with me on the phone Jim Moore. He's the attorney who represented local Lodge 123 of the Fraternal Order of Police in the case. Jim's a longtime labor side labor lawyer from Oklahoma, and this is just one of many cases that he has handled. And parenthetically, may I say, one on the issue of what's negotiable in Oklahoma. So welcome to our podcast, Jim.
Thank you, Will. Happy to be here.
First of all, could you tell us something that may solve a mystery that is in some of our listeners' minds? Collective bargaining exists in Oklahoma for police? How did that happen?
It is an anomaly, and there are people here that are still scratching their heads about that, but we've had it for police and fire since 1971. At the time, it was really more of a public safety issue than a labor issue, as you might guess. And that was part of the reason, but it wasn't altruistic. This was a time when there were garbage strikes and police strikes going on around the country. And it's no coincidence that our law starts out in the very first sentence saying strikes by public safety employees are prohibited and made unlawful, and a lot of bad things can happen to you. And oh, by the way, you have some bargaining rights now. So that's essentially how we got it.
How long has Lodge 123 represented Oklahoma City police officers?
It was one of the first police unions in Oklahoma, and it came along within a couple of years of the time the law passed, so early to mid-70s. And in fact, even though strikes were outlawed by the statute, the Oklahoma City Lodge is the only one that ever went out on strike, and that was in 1975, although they called it a mass resignation at the time, and it was over within a few days. But it's been very active since that time.
I don't think I've ever heard that before. Mass resignation?
Yeah. several hundred officers marched through the mayor's office and one by one plunked their badges on her desk. And they even carried one of the officers who had been injured in on a cot, and he struggled up and threw his on there as well. So it was quite a deal.
Oh, gutsy move.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the collective bargaining agreement and the key clause on which this body camera case rests. I think of it as kind of a maintenance of benefits clause. Is that the way it works?
That's exactly what it is. It's called various different things: maintenance of standards, maintenance of benefits. We refer to it as prevailing rights in Oklahoma. But essentially, it locks in or zips in the existing practices, policies, rules, and regulations that are in effect when the contract is signed. And those become, if not expressed, at least implied provisions of the contract.
Now, in the absence of a maintenance of benefits clause, under a general collective bargaining law, if an employer wanted to make a change in something that was mandatory for bargaining, it would have to initiate the bargaining process and then go through whatever the impasse resolution mechanism was. What does a maintenance of benefits clause get a labor organization that the general continuing duty to bargain does not?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one that the arbitrator addressed in this case, because in this contract there's both the maintenance of benefits clause and a general management rights clause, and those two are always in tension because the employer maintains they have a right through management rights to implement certain things without bargaining, and we're typically on the other side saying, no, if you're changing anything that exists right now or trying to add something that doesn't exist, then you must bargain it. And in this particular case, the arbitrator weighed that tension and said, because the implementation of body-worn cameras is such a large change in terms and conditions of employment. In other words, it's not de minimis. It's going to fall into the maintenance of standards and trigger the duty to bargain.
Let's talk about this de minimis notion. Not every working condition can possibly be negotiable, right?
Correct.
And there is some sort of balancing, I would assume, that has gone on under Lodge 123's contract, where you look at a working condition and you weigh the impact on employees against the employer's entrepreneurial decision-making process. Is that correct?
Exactly, and that's how it's operated for many, many years.
Now, go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, we've had a sort of an unwritten agreement with department management for years that whenever there's a change in policy, and as you know from being around police departments, they are voluminous, but whenever there's a change in a policy, the management will usually send it to the FOP to look at, comment on, and then move on from there. And we move on in one of three ways. Most typically, the lodge doesn't have a problem with the change because most of those changes are what I call police procedures and not really terms and conditions of employment. There are times when we might disagree with a portion of it, discuss those with the department, and reach some kind of an agreement on a modification, and they go into effect. Or, like the body-worn camera, we discuss it for a while, agree on part of it, not agree on all of it, and they go ahead and implement it. And whether or not the lodge takes a position and files a grievance alleging it violates the contract through the maintenance of benefits clause or not usually depends on just what you said. How significant is this really?
Now, I have tumbled to one of your maintenance of benefits clause arbitration decisions in the past, one that dealt with a change in tattoo policies.
Yes.
But you've had others as well.
Yes, we have. I can't even remember all the ones we've had. And by the way, I will say that, you know, I would like to take credit for bargaining this particular provision in the contract, but really it was borrowed from state law. We have a comparable maintenance of benefits clause in our state bargaining statutes. So something similar appears in a lot of collective bargaining agreements around the state for police and fire. And so I've had a number of these kinds of cases asserting the maintenance of benefits clause on a lot of different subjects. So, yeah, it's not a new approach. It was just a new issue.
Let's talk for a moment, and then I promise you I'll be through setting the stage here for the discussion of body cameras. Let's talk for a moment, because it's always a hot topic, about the tattoo case. Mm-hmm. What happened in that one?
Well, again, that was a maintenance of standards or benefits case, and the existing departmental policy on appearance had greatly detailed descriptions of, you know, how long the mustache can be, how much it can hang over the lip or the sideburns or your hair to the collar or the lipstick color or nail polish, the way the uniform looks, all those things, but it didn't address tattoos. And primarily the reason for that is because it was about a 25-year-old policy and the only tattoos were, you know, of the USMC insignia on someone's shoulder that no one cared about. And as tattoos became more popular, the department just basically unilaterally implemented a policy that there can't be any visible tattoos. And even people who were hired with those were told to either have them removed or permanently cover them up when they were at work. And the FOP took the position that we had a policy that was part of our contract that addressed appearance, but that was silent on tattoos. And if they wanted to change that policy and include tattoos, it had to be something they bargained. The department disagreed with us. We went to arbitration, and an arbitrator agreed that it did violate the maintenance of benefits clause.
In other words, it was a negotiable working condition the city couldn't unilaterally implement without reaching an agreement with you.
That's right, and that the policy itself, the change in policy, was a significant enough change in working conditions that it did have to be bargained. It affected enough officers, and it affected them in ways that were bothersome enough, I guess you might say, that it had to be bargained.
Now let's bring this up to the present, or I guess bring it back to 2014, and the city wants to implement a body-worn camera policy. What happens between the FOP and the city in the lead-up to this arbitration?
Well, ironically, Will, I think you started all this. And the reason I say that is because some Oklahoma City FOP officers had gone to one of your seminars in which you discussed body-worn cameras, or there was a lot of discussion about it, and they came back full of ideas on what a policy ought to look like here, and also with the practical recognition that at some point we were going to have it. It was just that wave that was sweeping the country, and it was going to happen. And so they decided to get ahead of the curve and went to the department management with a list of things that they wanted to see in a body-worn camera policy if and when the department got to that point. And the department was not far behind them. Created a working group to begin to study the policy, and actually allowed the FOP representative, John George, who was president, to sit in on those. And there were discussions over a year period of time, going back and forth and modifying some of the things the department wanted to do. It would either accept or reject the suggestions by the FOP, and they worked through those one by one. Although they were very careful to never call that bargaining. they were meeting and conferring over a mandatory subject, but they didn't want to call it bargaining.
Just friendly discussions, right?
Right. Yeah, just some people talking about something. So at some point, it was late summer of last year, 2015, the police chief was getting a little bit of pressure from the city council and maybe from some citizens on, hey, when's the department going to do this? You've been talking about it. We want to see some action. And he eventually decided that he had cooperated enough with the FOP that there was not going to be an agreement on the one major sticking point. And he went ahead and went to council and had them basically pass the policy and put it into effect.
Well, one thing I found absolutely fascinating about your situation is I completely mis-anticipated what the sticking point would be. I thought the sticking point was going to be whether officers who were involved in a critical incident had the right to review body camera videos before giving a statement or writing a report. But that wasn't an issue, was it?
It was not. That was one of the things that John George and Mark Nelson, on behalf of the FOP, were able to accomplish in those meetings. And you're right, that's a big deal. But our chief really is a pretty reasonable person. He spent some years on the street, and he understands. And I think the other thing that persuaded him was, with the advent of the Open Records Act, where anybody, literally anyone in the world, can get their hands on those videos, post them on the internet for everyone else in the world to see, it didn't make sense to keep those away from the officer at a time when it was pretty important that a report be accurate or testimony be accurate, or, you know, for whatever reason, the officer might need to review the facts before he or she made a statement. So I think that's how we got to that point.
So what was your sticking point? What drove the FOP to arbitration?
Random review of the videos. And that in itself was sort of ironic because we had participated in a couple of other rounds of negotiation over other subjects that involved random review and were able to come to agreements on those. And one was drug and alcohol and how random testing would be done, under what conditions, et cetera. And the second was the GPS AVL systems that the police vehicles have, where officers can be tracked in lifetime on a monitor, and whether or not a supervisor could basically randomly follow an officer by activating that system. And in both of those instances, we were able to bargain provisions that supervisors couldn't just randomly review a particular officer, single somebody out, track their every movement for a day, or you know, require them to undergo drug or alcohol testing without probable cause. And we saw this in the same light because it was going to allow the department at any time to review minute by minute an officer's performance on a daily basis. And anybody who has a boss at work understands that if someone's going to be watching your performance, especially at tense or critical times, and critiquing it, they're going to find something wrong. And that was the primary sticking point. We weren't opposed to review, and in fact, we put evidence in the case from the Police Executive Research Forum, PERF. They produced a pretty large study on body-worn cameras and had input from a couple of hundred agencies around the country. And one of their recommendations was not to have an officer's supervisor be doing random reviews of the body-worn camera footage.
So because it would. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say because it basically would cause a rift in that relationship between the supervisor and the officer.
On the key issue, when you're in arbitration, what does the arbitrator say as to whether the body-worn camera policy, and in particular this issue of supervisory review, random supervisory review, what does the arbitrator say about whether that's negotiable?
He looked at it from the standpoint of the change in working conditions, and he basically tracked what I just said, which is, when the department now acquires the ability to examine an officer's performance on a minute basis like that, to have video and audio recordings of an officer performing his duties all day long, then that shifts it into a different area. And that because they've got that information, there ought to be some restriction on reviewing it. You know, we're allowing you to have this, but there ought to be some sort of guidelines or restrictions on how it can be used. And he saw the wisdom in that, and he agreed with that. And he frankly was surprised whenever we started the case. He said, you know, I've been reading a lot about body-worn cameras. He said, kind of excited to be able to be involved in this case. And we told him, well, you know, about 95% of it's been agreed to, but there is a part that we still have a problem with. And he got there from the angle that everything we did was really a mandatory subject of bargaining. All of the agreements that were made in the provisions that we dealt with were mandatory subjects. And even though we had reached a tentative agreement on most of it, they couldn't implement just the portion that was agreed to. They had to hold off until it was all done, which by the way, led to the remedy, which was that the department had to cease and desist from implementing the program at all. They've got to put that on hold now until they bargain and reach an agreement on the final piece.
And so where do you go from here? Well, the arbitrator said they violated the contract, they had an obligation to bargain, has ordered cease and desist. I assume all the body cameras are coming off to the extent they were ever on. What happens now?
Well, and they were on, and they have been on, and in fact, there are some investigations already going on over potential violations of policy that showed up on those. So all that's going to be sort of put on hold right now. We're in the middle of contract negotiations for the next fiscal year, and we anticipated the award would be coming in before we got a contract, and we put the entire policy back on the table as a bargaining subject. So it's just been sitting there like a big elephant, nobody wanting to touch it, until we found out what the results of the arbitration case were. And now that we have those, it's already positioned to be bargained as part of our contract. So I think we'll just pick it up from there, and we will see if we can knock out that last issue.
And you raised something that I think is a fascinating question. In terms of the remedy in these duty to bargain cases, you have some video out there that's been reviewed that is potentially evidence of officer misconduct. Wouldn't the logical remedy for breach of duty to bargain be suppression of that video?
Yes, and that's what we're asking for in those. I think that remedy will arise probably within the individual officers' cases themselves, that basically they didn't have the right to use that technology, and without that there wouldn't be any evidence of any wrongdoing. I don't think that's going to be a big problem, actually, but it could be.
I want to close with just a couple of questions to you. One is just one, it doesn't have anything to do with body-worn cameras. It's just one I love talking to people who are in the same line of work as me about, and that is, isn't this a great line of work? Labor relations, and you and I represent unions, but I've had the same conversation with people who represent employers, and it's an intensely rewarding thing to do day in and day out, isn't it?
It is, and at times I have described it like divorce work, where the parties can't leave each other, because sometimes, as you know, those disputes get to be personal and get to be like marital discord. But we have to figure a way to work those out because we can't leave each other. But it demands creativity, patience, persistence, a lot of different things. And if you can get along with the people on the other side, you're right, it is very rewarding.
The relationship is the key. That's what's going to persevere over time, even in spite of disputes that arise from time to time.
That's true, and also another very rewarding part of it is to meet people that you represent. The young officers that come along, or firefighters in these organizations that step up, and you just watch them develop before your eyes, and the leadership skills and the confidence. It's that part's very rewarding as well.
Now, the other point I wanted to make is, don't you love it when your clients go to a seminar in Las Vegas and come back with all sorts of new ideas?
It keeps me on my toes, I'll tell you that.
That's my job, Jim.
Yeah, this is what Will Aitchison said. Are we doing that?
Hey, Jim, I want to thank you very much for your time and your willingness
You're so
to
welcome.
Do this. And congratulations again on the decision in the case. And I look forward to reading your next collective bargaining agreement. I'll bet there'll be something in body cameras in it.
Well, thank you much. It was good talking with you as well.
Okay, have a good afternoon.
You too. Goodbye.
That was Jim Moore, the attorney for Lodge 123 of the Fraternal Order of Police in Oklahoma City, one of the lawyers on what I think is the first case in the country on whether or not the implementation of a body-worn camera system is mandatory for bargaining. We hope to have you join us for our next First Thursday podcast, which will come out in the first Thursday of July. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.